Ladies and gentlemen, I'm here this evening to introduce both Professor Zander and the Hamlin Lectures. My name is Sidney Kentridge. This is the second of Professor Zander's lectures in this series of Hamlin Lectures. As those of you who were here last week, or indeed those of you who've ever been to a Hamlin lecture, will know, the Hamlin Lectures take place under the auspices of the Hamlin Trust, which was founded in terms of the will of the late Emma Hamlin, who died in 1941. In terms of her will and the trust, the general object of the Hamlin Trust was to inculcate a general knowledge of comparative jurisprudence of European countries. That was the general object. But the particular intent, as spelled out in the trust, was to ensure that the common people of the United Kingdom may realize the privileges which in law and custom they enjoy in comparison with other European peoples. That was certainly true in 1941, and some of us believe that it is still true. Notwithstanding the intent of the founder, I think one can say that the Hamlin Lectures, which have continued annually since 1949, have never been self-congratulatory in tone. Rather, the tone has been one of constructive criticism, as one would understand if one just thinks of the names of some of the previous Hamlin lecturers: Professor Hampson, Professor Glanville Williams, Lord Scarman, Lord Wolfe, Sir William Wade. And it's therefore particularly appropriate that Professor Michael Zander should be a Hamlin lecturer. He has always been a critic in the best sense of the word, in all his emanations, whether as writer, lecturer, or general legal gadfly. And he has always based his criticisms, when he had criticisms, on thorough knowledge, original research, and, of course, profound analysis. It is particularly pleasing that Professor Zander is the lecturer in this prestigious series of lectures at this particular time at the turn of the century. These are great days for the law. They are the days, inter alia, when we are thinking in terms of human rights, the Human Rights Act, and the incorporation of the European Convention of Human Rights. If there is any one person who has worked for that, it's Professor Zander. In 1973, he wrote and published a pamphlet, a Bill of Rights was its title, and which was frequently reprinted, and it's still worth reading. You will find no more cogent or persuasive case for the incorporation of the convention than you find in that pamphlet. And so it's particularly pleasing that Professor Zander is in the comparatively rare position of having had success in the field of legal reform. Now, Professor Zander is, whom I call Professor Zander, I hope correctly, is no longer a professor at the LSE. He's what's called an emeritus professor. I'm not sure what emeritus in this context really means. It's said that when Mr. Rupert Murdoch was sacking the editor of one of his newspapers, he made him the editor emeritus. And when the editor asked what emeritus meant, Rupert Murdoch said it comes from two Latin words, e meaning you're out, and meritus meaning you deserve it. On the other hand, my dictionary describes emeritus as applying to someone who has been honorably discharged from his public duty. Now, that wouldn't apply to Professor Zander either. In his case, emeritus means that he has been honorably discharged from his former duties so that he can undertake still more public duties for the benefit and entertainment of all of us. And I now ask him to give his second Hamlin lecture.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to be here for a second time and to see so many familiar faces and to have this occasion chaired by Sir Sidney Kentridge, recognized and acknowledged by, I think, everybody as the doyen of two great bars, the Bar of England and Wales and the Bar of South Africa. So it's a great honor for me that he's chairing this occasion. The topic tonight is civil justice. In my first lecture, I discussed the issues of justice and of access to justice with particular reference to the impending reforms to the legal aid system. This second lecture addresses the closely related question of civil justice. Civil justice concerns the handling of disputes between citizens arising out of civil as opposed to criminal law. The phrase is normally used to signify all stages of civil disputes by courts, including the issue of proceedings, settlement, trial, and post-trial appeals. In recent years, what is defined as civil justice has been broadened to include also a variety of other systems for resolving disputes, lumped together as alternative dispute resolution, or ADR. The subject has attracted much attention of late around the world. In this jurisdiction, we've had Lord Wolfe's famous reports on access to justice, implemented as a wide-ranging package of reforms as from last April. But the Wolfe report was only the latest in a long line of such reports. There have been over 60 official reports on the subject of civil process in the past 100 years. And no fewer than five since the Second World War. The Evershed Report in 1953, the report of the Wynne Committee in 1968, the Cantley Working Party in 1979, the Civil Justice Review in the late 1980s, and then Wolfe. The focus of such reports is always the same: how to reduce the complexity, delay, and cost of civil litigation. It seems that this is a subject that will not go away. It's safe to predict that the Wolfe Report will not be the last on the subject. Given the amount of official concern about the problem of civil justice, it's striking that there's so much about the subject that we do not know. Whether one looks at scholarly writing, empirical research, or official statistics, criminal justice is much better served than civil justice. Most university law faculties have several courses on aspects of criminal justice. There are hardly any courses on civil justice. The subject has been curiously neglected. But one thing we do know is that the disputes that reach a court for decision are a tiny fraction of the total number of civil disputes, and that most civil disputes do not even reach the level of being formal claims. To take one illustration, in 1984, the Oxford Socio-Legal Centre published a study of over 1,700 accidents where in every case the victim had suffered physical impairment lasting for 2 or more weeks. Only 1 in 7 made a claim. There were a mere 5 cases out of 1,711 that were decided in a contested hearing by a court. A pictorial representation of civil disputes is like a pyramid, with the base representing the mass of disputes and the apex representing the tiny proportion that reach a court, with the body of the pyramid representing the infinite variety of ways in which such problems are dealt with by citizens, with or without advice from others, and whether or not involving legal proceedings. the civil justice system is brought into play in only a small proportion of all these disputes. So the great and continuing preoccupation with reforming the system is energy applied to a very small portion of the total mass of civil justice problems in the community. Before a situation becomes a formal claim based on law, the victim has to appreciate that the law provides a possible remedy for what happened, which he then decides to pursue. If the person with the potential remedy is unaware of that fact, he obviously will do nothing about it. But even if the victim of the occurrence does realize that there is something that might be done, it by no means follows that he will do anything about it. There are a great many factors that can lead to a decision not to take action. To mention only a few, pessimism about getting the evidence to prove the case, fear of the cost, fear of the ordeal of giving evidence in court, combined with ignorance that few cases reach the court, ignorance of the law, for instance, that one's own negligence does not necessarily preclude an action, unwillingness to take action that might disrupt a continuing relationship, for instance, between landlord and tenant, employer and employee, or in a business relationship, concern over the delay involved, a sense of hopelessness, or a feeling that the cause is not sufficiently serious to justify the effort, the worry, and the bother. By a happy coincidence for me, the most sophisticated study of these issues to date has just been published by Professor Hazel Genn of University College London. She writes an article about her study in today's Times. Entitled Paths to Justice: What People Do and Think About Going to Law, the 260-page study, funded by the Nuffield Foundation, was based on screening interviews in their homes with a random national sample of over 4,000 individuals aged 18 or over, followed by face-to-face interviews with over 1,100 of the sample who had been identified as having a non-trivial justiciable problem in the previous 5 years. The social class profile of this main sample was close to that of the general population, which makes it possible to generalize from the results. Having indicated that they had experienced one or more of various types of legal problems, the 1,100 respondents were asked a series of questions about what, if anything, they had done about the matter. Only 5% said that they had done nothing at all. Those who took no action were most likely to have experienced problems relating to money, accidental injury, or work-related ill health, employment, clinical negligence, or unfair action by the police. These are hardly minor matters. Unsurprisingly, they were disproportionately likely to have low incomes and to have no or poor educational qualifications. They were also significantly less likely to have sought advice for previous problems. But 95% did make some attempt to deal with the problem. Mostly, this consisted of trying to take it up with the person directly responsible, such as the landlord, the employer, or the retailer. Sometimes this produced a result. Sometimes it did not. The success rate varied from one problem to another. Overall, just over one-third of all the respondents resolved the problem by agreement. A little under half of them had some form of advice. In 14% of cases, the matter was resolved by adjudication of some kind, whether a court, a tribunal, or an ombudsman. But whereas there were far more people in the sample who initiated the case than had a case brought against them, amongst those who had some form of adjudication, it was the other way around. So in just over half the cases, no result was achieved. Apart from the few who, as has been seen, did nothing, some abandoned the matter without taking advice, some abandoned it after taking advice, and a few abandoned it after taking legal proceedings. In about half those cases, the matter seemed to have reached some form of closure, at least in the sense that it was no longer current. In the rest, it was still current, but usually, the respondent said, he did not intend to pursue it further, typically because there seemed nothing else to do, or it would cost too much, or the respondent was fed up with the problem and had had enough of trying to sort it out. In trying to understand what the figures mean in terms of unmet need, the proportion seeking and obtaining advice is obviously significant. Just over half the sample took advice of some sort. But it would be wrong to jump to the conclusion that the other half didn't know how to go about seeking advice. As many as 4/5 of all the respondents were aware of the existence of the Citizens Advice Bureau, and more than 9 out of 10 people interviewed had received advice from some advisor in the past to help them resolve other matters. And as many as 68% had even been to a lawyer. 68% had been to a solicitor on a previous occasion. Of those in the sample who took no advice on this occasion, 4 out of 5 had previously taken advice. The fact that most people seem to know about the existence of CABs is especially important, as they provide a great nationwide free information and advice service, and plans for the government's community legal service rightly give them a central role. In 1997 to 98, the CABs dealt with over 6.2 million problems. It's also very significant that Professor Genn's survey shows that CABs are used extensively by all income groups other than those with incomes of 40,000 or more. When those who had considered seeking advice from solicitors or a Citizens Advice Bureau or other advisor had not done so, typically it was because they thought that nothing could be done about the problem, or that it would involve too much trouble, or would be too expensive. In some cases, it was because the problem was resolved before the contact was made. I suspect that probably not a great deal can be done to reduce those reasons for not taking advice. Some of those who had not taken advice reported practical problems, such as the limited opening hours of citizens' advice bureaus, the waiting time to get an appointment, difficulty in making telephone contact to arrange an appointment, congestion, and therefore queues in the office, and such like. Such problems could be addressed if sufficient funds were there to expand the CAB service, but whether that will prove possible must be doubtful. For anyone who thinks that in a well-ordered system, a good proportion of people with legal problems ought to be using legal proceedings, Professor Genn's study will be very discouraging. In about 8 out of 10 problems in the sample, no legal proceedings were started, no ombudsman was contacted, and no alternative dispute resolution method was used. In summary, therefore, what emerges is that first, most people with legal problems do something to try to resolve them, if only to complain. Secondly, very few of them use the official civil justice system, despite the fact that they know about taking advice from citizens' advice bureaus and solicitors. And thirdly, that most give up without getting any form of resolution of the matter. Is this a good thing or a bad thing? That is a crucial question, but it's not one to which there is any easy answer. Professor Genn did not attempt to make a judgment as to whether respondents were sensible in their decision to pursue or not to pursue the matter. She did discover, however, that over 2/3 of all the respondents said they did not regret anything about their handling of the matter. Whether one thinks that a person should involve him or herself in legal proceedings can only be answered sensibly in the context of a particular situation with knowledge of the full facts. How important is the matter to the individual? What would be involved in terms of time, cost, and stress in trying to get it resolved? If a widow with small children says that she did not claim in respect of the death of her husband killed in the course of his employment because she couldn't be bothered, or she was worried about having to go to court, or she didn't know how to proceed, everyone would agree that the failure to act was, to say the least, problematic, given the gravity of the situation and the value of the potential claim. The reason given would be an insufficient justification for inaction. She ought to have done something to pursue the matter. Something or someone must be at fault for the failure to do so. But to take an opposite extreme case, if a businessman who has spent good money on having lawyers draw up a complicated contract decides to sort out a problem arising out of the contract over a drink rather than bringing in his legal advisors, one takes an entirely different view. He can be expected to know where his best interests lie, and if he chooses not to use the legal system, why would one object? Or, to take examples that could affect any of us, if couldn't be bothered or it isn't worthwhile applies to the common irritations of ordinary life, the defective, moderately costly consumer item, the collision that puts a dent in one's car, the holiday hotel that doesn't quite come up to expectations, the landlord's failure to do routine repairs. One generally grins or groans and bears it oneself, and on the whole, probably expects others to do likewise. A society where everyone was actively engaged in asserting his or her legal rights might be an uncomfortable place. It's relevant in that context that in 9 out of 10 legal problems with a money value in Hazelgen's study, the amount involved was under £5,000. 9 out of 10. Trying for research purposes to evaluate someone else's decision to do nothing in pursuing a legal remedy is therefore an exercise fraught with difficulties. It's only in the rare extreme case that one can confidently assess the failure to act as problematic rather than understandable or even laudable. Can anything be done to change people's appreciation of their legal situation and so influence their decision whether or not to take up the legal cudgels? I suspect that the scope for making a difference is not as great as is sometimes supposed. No doubt, more information about law, legal remedies, the legal system, and about how to get advice, assistance, and representation would help. And it seems certain that in the coming years, there will be an explosion in the amount of such information available, notably, for instance, on the internet. But I would be very surprised if the information explosion greatly affects the basic shape of what I've called the pyramid. One reason is that millions of people are functionally illiterate and are therefore unlikely to be able to take advantage of personally having access to information about legal problems and legal remedies. But more important, Professor Genn's study suggests that people generally fail to pursue their legal remedies for a variety of reasons other than a lack of relevant information or advice. It's conventional wisdom that people would use the official legal system more if it were more user-friendly and cheaper. The Wolf reforms were essentially based on that thesis. The evidence, however, is to the contrary. The history of the Small Claims Court is in this respect instructive. When the county court was established in 1846, it had a maximum jurisdiction of £20. The jurisdiction gradually increased, but relative to the High Court, the county court was the place for small claims. Yet those who used the system as plaintiffs were basically traders to recover their debts. The Consumer Council's 1970 study, Justice Out of Reach, showed that individuals hardly ever used the county court as plaintiffs. That realization led to the establishment in 1973 of the Small Claims Court within the county court, with a special procedure designed to make it more attractive to ordinary people. A small claims case, typically, is handled in a private hearing in the judge's chambers, usually without lawyers. The parties are seated across the table from each other, with the district judge at its head. Neither the judge nor the lawyers, if there are any, wear wigs or robes. The judge may help the parties, who appear without a lawyer, to make their case. The atmosphere is likely to be considerably more relaxed and informal than proceedings in open court, where the judge and the lawyers are wigged and robed, and where the traditional adversary system operates. The general rule is that each side pays his own costs. The system is popular amongst those who use it. Professor John Baldwin's recent survey of the view of litigants in the county court concluded that whereas almost every interview with litigants who had been through the ordinary open court trial produced complaints, there were few complaints from the small claims litigants, and that they broadly liked the system. Quote, no matter what criterion of litigant satisfaction was adopted, the small claims regime came out ahead, and by a wide margin, said Professor Baldwin. The small claims jurisdiction has been rapidly increased and now stands at £5,000. Far more cases are now handled in the small claims system than in ordinary hearings in the county court. But if one asks the question, who uses the small claims court, the answer is still, above all, small business to recover debts. Professor Baldwin's verdict, on the basis of extensive research in this country, in the United States, and in Canada, where the position is exactly the same, said this, the evidence in this and other studies shows that while such mechanisms, meaning small claims courts, provide a means whereby access to justice might be extended, in practice, they continue to be used by very limited sectors of the population, particularly professional people or those representing business interests. And any hopes that the small claims context might provide an avenue through which the poor might find redress for their grievances seems to have no empirical basis whatsoever. In fact, Baldwin's view is that recent increases in the jurisdiction have not even had the effect of bringing in new cases. Rather, it seems to have resulted merely in transferring cases that would previously have been dealt with in the ordinary procedure in the county court to the small claims arena. In itself, that may be worthwhile, but it's not the purpose of having small claims courts. If the user-friendly and relatively inexpensive small claims court will not bring in the punters, there is obviously little hope that simplifying the procedure or reducing the costs in the ordinary courts will have that effect. Is the answer, therefore, to encourage people to use some form of alternative dispute resolution? There's no doubt that there is today a powerful movement of informed opinion, both in this country and in many other countries, that favors ADR. It is, as they say, the flavor of the month. In his interim report, Lord Wolfe devoted a whole chapter to the subject. His recommendations are reflected in the new civil procedure rules. One of the ways in which the courts are told to manage cases in the overriding objective, stated in Rule 1 of the new rules, is by encouraging the parties to use alternative dispute resolution procedure where that is appropriate. And failure to cooperate with the court's suggestions regarding ADR can result in cost penalties. The legal profession, very sensibly, has already shown great interest in adapting to this new development, which shows signs of being a lucrative new form of business. It was, for instance, reported this October that the international law firm Baker & McKenzie currently valued its global arbitration cases at £6 billion. Alan and Overy's partner in charge of arbitration was quoted as saying that he personally was handling billions on a regular basis. A consultant who's doing mediation full-time for Clifford Chance said it was the clients who were taking the lead. It's a very client-driven process because it puts clients in control of the outcome. Well, ADR involving amounts of millions or billions will mainly be confined to a tiny elite of city practitioners. But there are many signs that the general idea of ADR, be it mediation, arbitration, early neutral evaluation, or whatever, is catching on amongst the professionals. And there are more and more ADR providers of various kinds. But is it catching on amongst the potential customers? Here, one runs into an awkward fact. Although a Consumer Council survey in 1995 showed that a healthy majority of people said they would have preferred mediation or arbitration to a full trial, there is little sign that people actually offered the opportunity are inclined to take it. A recent study of the experimental scheme to promote ADR at the Central London Court, at the Central London County Court, shows how far away we are from broad acceptance of the concept. All litigants involved in non-family civil disputes involving amounts of over £3,000 were offered mediation at the nominal cost of £25. The study, again by Professor Hazel Genn, found that despite that very low cost, only 5% of litigants approached took up the offer. Those who did use the service achieved a settlement in just about 2/3 of the cases and generally were satisfied. In those cases, the process promoted and speeded up settlement and reduced conflicts. But it was unclear to what extent successful mediation saved costs, a critical question. Where it was unsuccessful, the mediation had the effect of increasing costs. The cost of the unsuccessful mediation had to be added to the cost of the traditional approach through the courts. Also, the level of damages was distinctly lower than that of the courts. Mediation for would-be divorcing couples under the Family Law Act 1996 seems also to be moving extremely slowly. The 1996 Act provided that couples considering divorce would be required to attend an information meeting at which they would get information about marriage counseling and on mediation. Results from pilot studies of these provisions proved disappointing. The numbers electing to use mediation was very low. Only 7% of those who attended the information meetings went on to mediation. The information meetings were based on voluntary attendance. The pilots were not actually designed to test the extent to which information meetings would divert people into mediation, although the Lord Chancellor seems to be using the results as his excuse for not going ahead with compulsory information meetings. But whatever the merits of this issue, it seems likely that only a small minority of divorcing couples will voluntarily opt for mediation. Quite apart from other reasons, it has to be borne in mind that for a mediation to operate, both partners must want it. ADR is not some form of magic potion. The 5-year RAND Corporation study of civil justice reforms, based on 10,000 cases in 20 federal courts in 16 states in the United States, looked also at ADR, mediation and early neutral evaluation schemes. The report found no statistical evidence that these forms of ADR, quote, significantly affected time to disposition or litigation costs. I'm wholly in favor of exploring the potential for every available method of ADR, but however much it expands, I do not believe that ADR will change the basic shape of the pyramid of disputes. Cases that get as far as starting legal proceedings represent the very top end of the pyramid. Those that are handled instead through some form of ADR are likely to be a small fraction of that number. My sense, therefore, is that ADR is unlikely to be more than a valuable but very small sideshow for the handling of some legal disputes. Professor Hugh Collins of the LSE Law Department recently put his finger on the nub of the point I'm making when he wrote in regard to contractual disputes, quote, "The contemporary emphasis of public policy to provide access to justice seems to be aimed at redistributing a good that parties to contractual disputes do not want. Consumers probably do not want to be bothered by formal dispute processes. I believe exactly the same is true, more or less, right across the vast canvas of civil disputes, with the exception of matrimonial matters, where legal proceedings, for obvious reasons, are common. When a dispute occurs, most people are prepared to complain, and many are prepared to go so far as to take advice. But on the whole, for a great variety of understandable reasons, they show little interest in using any of the forms of civil justice. I believe that this is not necessarily to be regarded as a bad thing. I also believe that to the extent that it is a bad thing, there is probably very little that can be done to change that situation. Does that mean that we should give up attempts to improve the civil justice system? The answer, of course, is no. We should do whatever we can to make it work as well as possible for those who do choose to use it. And the question then is, what reforms will improve the system? Some changes seem perversely designed actually to make matters worse. That applies to the recent significant increase in court fees, combined with the deplorable decision that the costs of running the civil courts, including even the costs of judicial salaries, should be recovered in full from litigants. The increase in fees has aroused widespread condemnation from all sides. The policy of making the courts self-financing, which was introduced by Lord Mackay, did not at the time provoke the uproar that might have been expected. But Sir Richard Scott, Vice Chancellor and Head of Civil Justice, was one who did speak up, describing the policy as, quote, indefensible from a constitutional point of view. The civil justice system, with the criminal justice system and the police, he said, was one of the three pillars on which the structure of justice in a civilized community stood. No one would suggest that the criminal justice system or the police should be self-financing. Why, Sir Richard said, should it be suggested of the civil justice system? A policy which treats the civil justice system merely as a service to be offered at cost in the marketplace and to be paid for by those who choose to use it profoundly and dangerously mistakes the nature of the system and its constitutional function. He expressed the hope that the then new Labour government would consign the policy of making the civil justice system self-financing to the dustbin. But instead, Lord Irvine continued the policy, ratcheting up the fees even higher and adding the new ingredient that the further the case goes, the higher the fees. There's probably now no hope that this highly objectionable policy will be reversed. In April of this year, the civil justice system underwent the most radical reform of the century through the implementation of the Wolfe reform package. Lord Wolfe's proposals were welcomed by almost everyone. I was one of the very few who did not welcome them, fearing that they would, on balance, make matters worse rather than better. It will take a while before one can judge whether those fears were justified. The first indications suggest that the new procedural rules are bedding in well, and there seems to be a general feeling that they've got off to a good start. But these early, somewhat encouraging signs do not throw much light on the overall impact of the reforms. Before explaining why I continue to have my doubts, I want to pay tribute to Lord Wolfe for the remarkable achievement of getting his project off the drawing board and into operation, and within so short a time. It can truly be said that he had a vision and that he largely translated it into action. The essence of the vision was that the well-known ills of civil litigation were mainly the result of the system and of the way that lawyers abused it. Litigation was conducted in too adversary a manner. Delays were endemic because a leisurely pace was accepted, and no attention was paid to time limits. Costs were out of proportion to the amount at stake. Lord Wolfe's answer was nothing less than to change the culture, to transfer the management of cases from the lawyers to the courts, to make everyone adhere to timetables, to require early preparation of cases, and to penalize unreasonable conduct by the parties. The new rules start with the overriding objective, that cases should be dealt with justly, And this is defined to mean ensuring, so far as practicable, that parties be on an equal footing, that a case be dealt with in ways that are proportionate to the amount of money involved, to the importance of the case, to its complexity, and to the financial position of each party, ensuring that it's dealt with expeditiously and fairly, and allotting to it an appropriate share of the court's resources, while taking into account the need to allot other resources to other cases. A consultation paper recently issued by the Lord Chancellor's Department on plans for the evaluation of the civil justice reforms said that broadly, the aim of the reforms had been described as seeking to reduce delay, cost, and complexity, and to increase fairness and certainty for litigants. That, it said, provided five indicators against which success could be judged. As to complexity, the White Book containing the rules runs to some 5,000 pages, and I reckon that we are in for at least 20 years of litigation to determine what they mean. I do not regard that as a huge advance in the direction of certainty. The single most important element of the Wolf reforms, I suppose, was to reduce the costs of litigation. One of my chief reasons for opposing the reforms was my belief that they will instead raise costs. The main reason is that the new rules require or encourage the parties to do more work earlier than before. The front-loading of costs bites on most cases, those that settle as much as those that go all the way to trial. It affects even cases where no legal proceedings are ever started. Almost all claims settle, usually without any form of legal proceedings. A leading insurance company has told me that in the 12 months to October 1999, it closed 16,500 personal injury cases. Nearly 9 out of 10 settled without any legal proceedings being started. In 12%, the case settled after proceedings had started, and in 1%, the matter reached trial. A feature of the new system is the pre-action protocols, which set out what is now to be regarded as proper conduct by the parties in regard to such matters as early disclosure of information before an action has even started. The personal injury protocol runs to 17 pages. The protocol on medical negligence claims runs to 25 pages. The purpose of these protocols is to create a climate or environment of reasonable behavior by both sides. Failure to comply with the protocols can be taken into account by the court at the end of the case when it comes to allocate costs. Under the protocols, the parties are required to do a variety of things before starting proceedings that previously they would not necessarily have done at that stage, if at all. To the extent that cases would previously have settled without such work, the costs incurred as a result of the protocols will be greater than before. The same applies to work done earlier in response to the requirement that each side puts its case from the outset. Moreover, the new emphasis on moving things along according to a tight timetable will cause both sides to do more preparation before commencing proceedings instead of leaving it as before to a later stage. One might say, quite right too, the sooner the litigants get their tackle in order, the better. But the effect is to front-load costs unnecessarily if the case would have settled without it. It's possible that in some of those cases, the settlement will come earlier or be more soundly based by virtue of more information. But that is mere speculation. What seems clear is that the introduction of the Wolf reforms will cause a general, across-the-board raising of costs through the direct and indirect effects of case management. The greater hands-on case management for multi-track cases, those involving amounts of over £15,000 with two pre-trial hearings, will generate even greater additional costs. Lord Wolfe's hope is that such additional expenditure pre-trial will save significant costs at the trial. But there is no empirical evidence to support that, whilst there are studies that show that pre-trial hearings do not shorten trials. Whilst judicial case management may and probably will result in better preparation of cases for trial, it is a recipe for increased costs rather than decreased costs, as Lord Wolfe finally acknowledged in 1997, a year after publication of his final report. It's interesting to speculate what impact his recommendations would have had if this had been appreciated earlier. The Lord Chancellor's Department's paper on evaluating the Wolfe reforms suggests that the hoped-for advance in regard to fairness will flow, for instance, from the impact of sanctions for unreasonable behavior and from the new rules on claimants' offers to settle. I'm wholly in favor of the new procedure for claimants' offers to settle. The defendant, typically an insurance company, has always had the right to pay a sum of money into court as an offer of settlement. If the plaintiff chooses to reject the offer and then fails to beat the sum paid in, he is penalized severely in costs. For him, it's a form of Russian roulette, with a devastating impact if he and his advisors guess wrongly as to what damages the court will award. Now the claimant can put the insurance company under some, though hardly equivalent, pressure. That seems to me a gain in terms of fairness, and I believe that it will also result in more early settlements. But the application of sanctions under the new rules is a very different matter. Sanctions are central to the Wolfe project. In his interim and final reports, Lord Wolfe was insistent that there had to be a sea change of culture in regard to time limits. The rules of court, he said, were being flouted on a vast scale. Timetables were not adhered to, and other orders were not complied with if it didn't suit the parties to do so. There'd been overwhelming support, he said, from all sides for, quote, effective, appropriate, and fair sanctions. The effectiveness of sanctions would require a much tougher approach from the judges. Lord Wolfe said, quote, there is no doubt that some judges at first instance, especially masters and district judges, will need to develop a more robust approach to the task of managing cases and ensuring that their orders are not flouted. And the judges would need to be supported by the appellate courts. Lord Wolfe said, procedural decisions must not be overturned lightly. This is not simply a matter of limiting appeals. It goes to the change of culture. My concern is that this policy does not allow sufficiently for ordinary human frailty, for the difficulties of running a busy lawyer's office, or for the fact that the cause of delay will often be wholly outside the control of the lawyers being penalized by the court. A 1994 study of delay in the High Court and the County Court, incidentally never cited by Lord Wolfe in either of his reports, a study done by KPMG Pete Marwick, identified a variety of causes of delay. The two that it said gave rise to the most significant delay were inexperience or inefficiency in the handling of cases by the party's solicitors and time taken to get medical or other reports. To make compliance with the rules central to the system of civil justice is to give procedural rules an importance they do not deserve. The point was made by Sir Jack Jacob QC, the leading civil proceduralist of our time, in his dissent to the report of the Wynne Committee in 1968. I quote, "The admonition by Lord Justice Bowen that courts do not exist for the sake of discipline should be reflected in the principle that rules of court should not be framed on the basis of imposing penalties or producing automatic consequences for non-compliance with the rules or orders of the court. The function of rules of court is to provide guidelines, not tripwires, and they fulfill their function most where they intrude least in the process of litigation. When the court visits," that's the end of the quote, "when the court visits severe penalties for a breach of the rules, it's generally acting harshly in the particular case, pour encourager les autres. It's predictable that sometimes the judges will take this approach, hardening their hearts and administering the punishment in the name of the principle that the rules must not be flouted. Incidentally, when they do so, lay litigants will often find themselves penalized for the failures of their lawyers. Not an obvious advance in justice. Sometimes, however, the court will be persuaded by the excuses and the justifications put forward on behalf of the party in default. What is predictable is that the courts will not be consistent in their approach, which is a recipe for unequal justice or less fairness. The problem of inconsistency of approach by the judges creating unfairness applies equally to a whole raft of new discretions given to the judges by the new rules. The procedural judge who is managing the case under the case management system, which is now the essence of the new rules, knows only what is presented to him by the parties. He has to make snap decisions based often on inadequate information. Inevitably, through no fault of his own, he will sometimes make decisions that are unwise or inappropriate. But it will be difficult to appeal such discretionary decisions, since the appeal courts, understandably, will not want to second-guess the procedural judge. As Lord Wolfe said in his final report, quote, management decisions are preeminently matters of discretion with which an appeal court would seldom interfere. So the move to judicial case management not only greatly increases the risk of inappropriate decisions resulting from the judge's lack of familiarity with the case, but equally increases the volume of low-level, inconsistent, discretionary decisions that are in practice unappealable. That, again, seems to me to be a step backward for fairness. Inconsistency of approach by the judges is a serious problem in the small claims courts, and the vast increase in the jurisdiction of these courts correspondingly increases the impact of the problem. The problem of variation in how the judges conduct small claims cases has been highlighted by Professor John Baldwin's research. The difference is not just a matter of style. It affects the extent to which the judge is prepared to help the parties to produce evidence or to act as his own expert when no relevant evidence is preferred by either side. It applies equally to whether the judge feels constrained to apply the law. Baldwin reports that only a minority of the 33 district judges he interviewed thought it was their duty strictly to apply the law. The majority said they thought they were entitled to disregard the law if, in their view, strictly applying it would produce injustice. This is strong meat. In his interim report, Lord Wolfe said it's questionable whether such differences are acceptable, even in a jurisdiction limited to £1,000. And that any inclination to follow common sense rather than the principles of law should be resisted in the interest of consistency. Baldwin, following the same line of thinking, observed, quote, decision-making can easily become inconsistent, capricious, uncertain, even biased, and in the process, the substantive legal rights of individuals may be undermined. Moreover, while flexibility is doubtless desirable in dealing with small claims, it can create uncertainty for lay litigants and their advisers. Lord Wolfe thought that the answer was more guidance and training for district judges in playing the interventionist role to achieve greater consistency. I regard this as wholly unrealistic. The difference flows from different perceptions of how to be a judge. Such differences cannot be smoothed away by training or guidance, especially they cannot be smoothed away in the context of low-level decisions in private hearings, often with no lawyers present, and where appeals are rare. Inconsistency of approach by the judges in the small claims jurisdiction is absolutely inevitable. I'm not sure that it's acceptable in cases involving amounts of up to £5,000. I would certainly question whether it's acceptable in cases involving larger amounts. One of the important new rules introduced as part of the Wolf reforms gives the judge at the end of the case the task of allocating costs in accordance with which party has won on the different issues raised, and in accordance with his view as to how reasonably or unreasonably the parties have conducted themselves, both during the trial and pre-trial, including even before the proceedings were started. This replaces the previous rule applied by the courts, under which the winner more or less automatically got his costs. The issue required no argument. The decision took less than a minute. Clearly, the aim of the new approach is to increase the fairness of the cost system. One effect will, of course, be to increase costs, since time will now have to be taken, sometimes at a separate later hearing, to delve into the rights and wrongs of the conduct of the case by the respective parties. But also, the costs decision, though aimed to increase justice, may do the exact opposite if the judge makes his decision on the basis of an insufficient grasp of the facts. In an early landmark decision interpreting these new rules, a High Court judge reduced the winning local authority's costs from 100% to 75% on account of relative success on the issues, and then to 50% on account of conduct. The solicitor for the winner, writing about the case, made the following understandably critical observations. Quote, "The decision to reduce the apportionment which the judge would otherwise have made in the counsel's favour from 75% to 50% as a result of the counsel's conduct is a subjective and wholly imprecise assessment by the judge of the way in which he considered the conduct of the litigation had increased costs. The judge had only the information which had been made available during the trial upon which to make this assessment, and no specific evidence was put forward by either party on costs. There was no information upon which any sort of reasoned decision could be made as to the amount of such reduction." That goes to the question of whether the judge's allocation of costs is likely to be just. There is also the effect of increased uncertainty about the outcome and its potential impact on the attractiveness of using the legal system at all. The points on which the winner in that case had failed, which led the judge to reduce the costs order to 75%, had been decided at trial only after lengthy oral argument for and against. They were not spurious points. If the winner is not going to get his costs for costs incurred on issues on which he lost, how are lawyers supposed to advise their clients as to what points to take? Are they to advise that reasonable and seemingly winnable points should not be taken for fear that they might be lost? The new rule introduces a range of new uncertainties. As to increasing certainty and reducing delay, the new system should secure some gains. To know from an early stage that the hearing will be on a particular day or during a particular week and that it's difficult to get the court to grant an extension of the timetable, no doubt helps to concentrate minds and to move things along. Not that it necessarily follows that things have actually speeded up. As has been seen, one of the effects may simply be that the case is prepared before proceedings are launched onto the fast-track conveyor belt. But even if it is handled more quickly, there may be a price to be paid for the increase in certainty and tighter timetables. The point is clearest in the fast track, which will apply to most cases involving amounts of between £5,000 and £15,000. All cases in the fast track must be given a date of trial, failing which a window of 2 or 3 weeks, not more than 30 weeks from the date of allocation. If a case is too complex to be prepared in 30 weeks, it should be allocated to the multitrack. But how can the judge allocating the case be expected reliably to get the allocation decision right? The RAND study in America showed that frequently the allocation decision is highly problematic. There will be cases, perhaps many cases, in which it turns out that 30 weeks is not enough time. The refusal to grant an extension of time in such a case will undeniably give increased certainty to the system, but if there's not enough time to prepare the case, it may cause injustice to one party or perhaps to both. reactions after 6 or so months of the Wolf reforms have been mixed. A preliminary survey published by the Law Society in September stated, quote, "The majority of respondents believe that although it's early days, the civil procedure rules are working quite well. However, there is a feeling that the real test will come when fast-track cases start coming up for trial, 30 weeks from the end of April, so about now. Some practitioners have reported that backlogs at county courts are causing a large problem, and that interpretation of the rules appears to vary from court to court. There is also concern that in some cases the new rules appear to have increased costs and not reduced them. For example, some solicitors are having to spend their week travelling around the country to attend case management conferences. Also, some respondents complained that costing files at the case management conference stage in the manner of a summary assessment involves detailed work which does not progress matters in any way." That was the Law Society very brief assessment. On the matter of single experts, as proposed by Lord Wolfe, it does seem that at least in fast-track cases, parties are opting to have a single expert for both sides much more frequently than had been anticipated. Thompson's, the country's largest personal injury law firm with 17 offices nationwide, which at any one time is handling thousands of personal injury cases, recently sent the Lord Chancellor's Department a short memorandum indicating its first views as to how the reforms were working. The verdict was mixed. The fast track, it said, was working in the sense of producing settlements. The new rule permitting the claimant to make an offer of settlement was also working and increasing settlements. Pre-action protocols, however, did not seem to be leading to early settlements. On judicial case management, the centerpiece of the Wolf reforms, the memorandum was scathing. "Judicial case management is, in our experience, a disaster. It is involving far greater work than before, and that means far greater cost. It's leading to the front-loading of casework. The judiciary are applying sanctions without having considered first what the case is about and what is happening within it." The Lord Chancellor's Department plans itself to conduct research on the effect of the Wolf reforms. The question is not whether the new system has positive virtues. I have no doubt that it does. The question is whether the strengths of the new system outweigh the weaknesses as compared with the balance of strengths and weaknesses in the old system. It will be a considerable time before we can begin to reach a concluded view, and in all probability, even then, there will be disagreement. Whatever the ultimate verdict on these major reforms, there will be need for further improvements. The task of providing a good system for those who come seeking civil justice is permanent. We should be ready to return to the drawing board again and again and yet again. But whilst tinkering with the system, we should bear in mind that we are operating at the very top of the pyramid, and that the overwhelming majority of disputes will always be dealt with and resolved or not resolved without recourse to any form of dispute resolution system, be it mainstream courts or some form of ADR. We should also bear in mind that it's difficult to be sure whether that is a matter for concern or for celebration. Is it a good thing or a bad thing when someone goes in pursuit of civil justice? It could be either or both at the same time. One wouldn't wish a lawsuit on anyone. And yet, taking up the cudgels is often the only way to get or to preserve one's rights. Does one want more of it or less of it? I find myself unable to answer that question. Thank you.
Professor Zander has kindly agreed to answer questions from the audience. We have only about 10 minutes for it, so could I ask you to be sure, if you have a question to ask, that it is a question. There's unfortunately no time for comments, so questions, and preferably short questions, are invited.
We have a mic. Right. If you could use the mic.
We don't always need one, but
well,
I will.
Upstairs, maybe.
Professor Zander, could I just pick three phrases you used in the course of your talk tonight? The Convention on Human Rights, Russian Roulette, and Judicial Discretion. And could I just ask you whether you would suppose that the Convention will apply to citizens' civil rights in, for example, occupational pension schemes set up under trust law? The Times report recently, you may remember, on the Scottish Deputy Sheriff's case was headed, "Appointment System Destroys Judicial Impartiality." It is a matter.
Could I interrupt you by saying that I am in fact going to be lecturing on the human rights aspect of civil of justice,
right,
in my last lecture. So can we postpone that whole issue?
I'm not
going to answer it now.
A fortnight today, is it?
A fortnight today.
I'll store it up and
next
try to get it concise for you.
Next week is criminal justice and the following week is human rights. The mic is coming at speed.
Thank you. Professor Zander, you said very rightly that the system is basically about settlement and that cases are going to cost more and they would have settled anyway. And it may well be that that will happen to some extent. However, one of the problems of the system has been that those cases that settle often settle very late, and that was much of the disadvantage of the system and to the litigants. Wouldn't you agree that the protocol system, which establishes a very minimum exchange of information between the parties, operates as a satisfactory platform for launching offers to settle, and therefore it does front load costs, but it's likely to do more justice?
Well, that may well be right. I have no concluded opinion about the effect. Obviously, we're going to have to look at the effect, and I hope proper research is going to be done. It'll be complicated, difficult research to do. That's a possibility. It's a question of balancing the gains and the losses. And there are clearly gains and there are clearly losses.
Do you accept that there's some need for stringent imposition of rules in an attempt to reduce delay, including the imposition of penalties, where one party to litigation is substantially better able to absorb the costs of delay than the other? For example, in litigation between insurance companies and private persons?
Well, at first sight, that sounds like an attractive proposition, and in some cases it surely is an attractive proposition. But insurance companies also have some interest in moving cases along, so I think it's probably wrong to say that they're always in delay, hanging on to their money. And I don't know. We don't know as much about that as we would like to know. I would guess that the case for sanctions to deal with delay would arise only in a very small minority of cases, where I think Lord Wolfe's premise is that it arises in a very large number of cases. So there's a big difference of opinion on that point between us.
Thanks. Do you think there's any chance that the layout of the books which contain the rules with the practice directions might be simplified? Because I find it's really quite a headache to find my way around them compared with the old green book and white book. I'm not at all in favour of the layout of the book which I have, that I use the Butterworths.
Well, that's an interesting point. I hear you.
Do you welcome the changes, such as they are, in relation to discovery or disclosure of documents? Do you think they go too far or not far enough? And is it possible to give even a preliminary view as to whether the changes are working as intended or not?
If it is possible to give a preliminary view, I'm not able to give one. I don't know. Practitioners may or may not already have a sense of it. But without going into the minutiae, which I think would not, in the time available, be possible,
I'm worried whether the curtailment of discovery, insofar as it is a curtailment, may cause injustice to occur as a result of material not coming forward that would previously have come forward, so that both sides can expect it. But I do have some sympathy, particularly in big cases, for the idea that too much discovery is too much of a good thing, and that maybe reining it back a bit it was legitimate. But we don't actually have any good empirical data about the extent of excessive discovery right across the board. And I would guess that it's not a problem right across the board, never was a problem right across the board. But we have no empirical data about that one way or the other.
Last question. Small claims cases may now be heard in public. Do you think that public hearings will aid consistency in judicial decision making, or will increased public hearings in fact act as a deterrent to individual litigants who fear their cases being heard with others sitting around?
That's a very interesting point. The new rules specify that small claims courts, which were previously to be held, as I've said, in private, should now be held in public. The reason for that is one is very simple, namely a fear on the part of the Lord Chancellor's Department that if they were not to be held in public, they would be in breach of Article 6 of the European Convention on Human Rights, already above mentioned and to be mentioned hereafter. Now, whether that will actually come to pass is, I think, an interesting question that we will see empirically, because we'll be able to go into county courts and discover what is meant by in public. I suspect that what is meant by in public in practice will be we continue as before in the judges' chambers, but we put on the door a notice saying in public. Are there any chairs for the public? No, there are no chairs for the public in the judges' chambers. So everything goes on pretty much as before. And maybe one person from the public manages to find his way into the judge's room. That is what I suspect will actually happen. So it's a kind of genuflection in the direction of the ECHR, the European Convention, without actually disturbing the very appropriate private nature of the hearings. I would be surprised if the judges generally adjourn small claims courts into open court. That would be very surprising to me. But I'm sure some will, but most won't, I suspect. If they did, and to the extent that they do, I agree with you that it would be likely to discourage some litigants who are very attracted by the idea of private justice as opposed to public justice. And we talk a lot about the desirability of public justice. As far as the litigants are concerned, it's for the birds. What they want is private justice. Yeah, sure.
One very last.
Assuming that there is unmet need and that perhaps more cases can you get to the small claims court than do, is there a case for the small claims courts, indeed all courts, being made user-friendly in a real sense of the word? We can go to Tesco now, right through the night often, and certainly after working hours. If you go to the Central London County Court, which you referred to, it is open 10 to 4 when most people are at work. If you try to get through on the telephone, as I did 2 weeks ago today, trying all day, I was totally unsuccessful. Mm.
Well, I've been to night court in New York. It's a ghastly experience. not to be encouraged, I can't believe that anyone would be the least bit attracted. And it wasn't particularly busy either. So I'm all in favor of experimenting with every conceivable form of making every public institution more user-friendly, but I'm deeply skeptical whether it will make much difference. So try it by all means, but observe whether in fact it works. And I suggest it probably won't work. Well, not at any rate to a noticeable extent.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, we've had the pleasure of once again hearing a uniquely fascinating and informative lecture from Michael Zander, and I'd ask you to thank him in the usual way.
Thank you very much.